Children, settle down. Okay, we're in Romans chapter 2. Romans chapter 1, verse 18 through chapter 3, verse 20 is talking about what? What does your outline say? Condemnation. How and why a person's lost. Lots of different ways to name it. How somebody tries to be saved under law probably is a good way to say it, because he's going to contrast when we get to chapter 3, verse 21. Now righteousness from God apart from law is made known. And so 1:18 to 3:20 is how a person tries to be righteous by keeping law. Any law. By the way, next Sunday, Lord willing, you'll have a substitute who's better than the regular teacher. So I'll just give you that little piece of information before so you'll know it whenever he gets up. So he's subbed in for me before and does a great job. So I really appreciate it. I haven't told you who it is, so you'll be surprised, won't you? Okay. In Romans chapter 2, we're setting the stage for a person who's under law, regardless of when he lived or where he lived, stands before God. He has never had a chance to have a Bible. He's never heard the gospel. He lived and died unaware of Jesus Christ or the cross or the church or baptism or the Lord's Supper or any of those things. How's God going to judge him? Is he going to open the Bible up and hold him to a standard that he never saw his whole life? Now, I don't know what you were taught growing up, but that's what I was taught growing up. And it bothered me, because it seemed to me, at least, to be incredibly unfair that someone's going to be held responsible to a standard that they never had the opportunity to know about. And because it seems unfair to me doesn't make it right or wrong. Okay, I want you to know that I understand that completely. God didn't ask my permission for anything he did, and he didn't have to. And if he had and I'd given him any advice different than what he did, I'd have given him the wrong advice. Because what God does is right. It's always right. It's never wrong. And so I understand that. And so when there is something in the Bible that I don't understand, or something that gives me heartburn, then I know that a red flag goes up, and I know I need to go study that some more. Because what God did was right. And we need to have that as an underlying principle of everything in our life. God, in him, there is not even the remotest possibility of sin. There's not even a shadow of turning. He's consistent. He is perfectly consistent from the first day of the creation until what we know time is no more. God's perfectly consistent in everything he does. And so I know that. But that doesn't mean that I don't have some difficulty and have some struggle sometime understanding some of the things that God did. There are some things that God did in the Old Testament that if he had asked me, I would have advised him to do differently. Now, I'm telling you, I would have advised him wrong. I understand that, but I still would have advised him to do differently. And there are a few folks' case in the Old Testament that I would have taken their case, if I were a lawyer, I would have taken it pro bono. You know, so that they didn't have to pay me unless I won. And I wouldn't have got paid a dime. But I sure would have pled their case, because it seemed to me like certain things that God chose not to do, he should have done, or something that God did, maybe he shouldn't have done just exactly that way. And so I don't know God as well as I need to know God. And as I read through the Old Testament and I read about God who told the children of Israel to go into the promised land and killed every man, woman, child, and beast, I struggle with that some. My mind intellectually can understand what he said. He said their cup of iniquity is full. And I translate that to mean that that society had become so wicked and corrupt that there was nothing in that society that would have caused a person to turn to God. And so it was an act of mercy in what he did. But I still have a hard time thinking of me being a soldier and running a child through with a sword. Don't you? So that tells me there's some things about God that I need to know. And one of the things that that tells me is that being right and being righteous is more important to God than human life. And that translates personally for me to say that it's more important to God that I be righteous than that I live. Living is not the most important thing for a Christian. I mean, we reason, well, I have to do this in order to live. Maybe you do have to do that in order to live. But who said you had to live? You're going to die, aren't you? And I'd rather die with God's approval than outside of it, hadn't you? And so there are some things that we need to adjust about our thinking. And one of the things that I've struggled with my life, and I think for every person who is concerned about spiritual things, and that this is a process that we have to go through, We were taught certain things as children. And a lot of us were taught in some form or other that God required that you do everything right. And so we tried to be good. And I've learned also it's easier for some people to be good than others. That's true. Some people, it's relatively easy for them to be good. They have a tender conscience and concerns. And others, it's really hard for them to be good. But regardless of which side of that fence you may be on, if you're really honest, you come to a point where you're just totally frustrated because you try to be good. And you make some promises to God that you can't live up to. And you promise him that if he'll give you one more chance, you won't ever do it again, and you lie. You did it again. And so you bargain with him if he'd give you one more chance, you wouldn't do it for sure the next time, but you lied again, and you did it again. And you promised him that you would do certain things, but a little bit of time passed, and you didn't do it. And it bothered you when you didn't do it, or when you did do what you promised you wouldn't do. It bothered you for a while, but then you looked around you and everybody else is about the same way, so it didn't bother you as much after a while because you kept doing it. And it comes as a real shock to us to hear the reality that there will not be one single sin in heaven. Not one. And there'll never be a single sin that's committed that is not punished. There won't be any that slip through the cracks. You might think you got away with it, but you didn't. You're just fooling yourself. You don't pull the wool over God's eyes. And there's only one punishment for death. I mean, for sin. Romans 6:23 is what? Wages of sin is death. There's only one. And James says, if a man keeps the whole law and just breaks it one time, guess what happens to you? You get the penalty as if you had broken all the law. You're dead. And so this is really, really, it puts it on a different level if you really understand that there won't be any sin in heaven. None. Not one. If you stand before God and you've got one single sin charged against you, God doesn't have a choice about what to do with you. He's not going to weigh you in balances in the top 10% go to heaven. If you have one single sin charged to your account when you stand before God, God has no choice but to say, depart from me. Now, what does that do to my attempts to be good? I mean, what's the point? I've already got my strike. In fact, I've gotten mine multiple times. And if there's nothing I can do, if sin separates me from God and there's nothing I can do to reconcile myself to God, then what's the point? And you know, there are lots of folks that are just that way, that they get to that point and they try to be good and they can't be good. And you keep trying and you keep trying, and then you come to a point where you have some choices to make. Okay, how am I going to deal with this problem I've got? Am I going to get discouraged and quit? And there are many who do. Because you don't see any alternative to it. I've tried and I've tried and I've tried to be good and I can't be good. And so why keep trying? I'm just making myself miserable. And there are other people who will look around and say, you know what? Look at the preacher's kids. Look at the elders. Look at the preacher. Look at this one. Look at this one. I'm doing as good as they are. And so we don't have much hope, but that's our hope. We gauge ourselves by others. And we act like God's going to grade on the curve. But he's not. And when in our mind, when we get some mindset like that, then we've got to put ourselves somehow in the top small percentage of people in the world. Good. How do we go about doing that? Well, you can do it the hard way, and you can really, really, really try to be good, and you'll probably become paranoid. Or either you can start criticizing people who look like they're doing better than you. Now, that's a lot more fun. And that's easier. And so we get to the point that if there's somebody that looks like they're doing better than we are, then we start trying to find fault with them. And that gets to be a way of life. I've been around people like that, haven't you? That they can't find anything good. They smell flowers and they think of a funeral. Everything. Everything. Everybody has to jump through my hoops. Everybody has to pass muster with me. And I'm not going to let you. And if it looks like that you're doing pretty good, I'm going to raise the bar higher. So that you can't, because you see, if I can find fault with you in some twisted way, that makes me feel better about myself. But it doesn't make you any better to criticize other people. And it really gets to be a neat thing when we all understand, and one of the blessings of the true gospel and really comprehending our own circumstances and how we get our righteousness, it puts us all in the same boat on the same side, and I don't have to put my foot on your throat. I don't have to criticize you. I don't have to find fault with you. I don't have to pick you apart. Because I'm right there with you. I'm a sinner, and if I'm saved, I'm saved by God's grace. And so I don't have anything to brag about. And when we really get to understand that this person that society looks down on, who's immoral and ungodly and maybe a prostitute and a drunk and whatever else you want to put on that person, they can get to heaven just as easy as I can get to heaven. And they're as righteous as I am, because we're all sinners. And that's where we're going with Romans 1:18 to 3:20. And until we understand that, until we have all of our self-righteousness taken away from us, then we're not going to accept the gospel. We'll come to the cross standing straight up with our pride intact. But when we really, really understand what he's telling us in Romans 1:18 to 3:20, we'll get down on our face. And we will say, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. And we won't be trying to judge somebody else against ourselves and try to make ourselves look better by criticizing somebody else. What does that accomplish? Except to make yourself feel better. It's a cheap way of trying to make yourself look righteous. Criticism. But we're back here with our guy that's under law. And we're talking about here he stands before God. He lives and dies, and he never had a chance to hear the gospel, and he stands before God to be judged. How is God going to judge him? What principles is God going to use? Is he going to open the Bible up and say, Ken Stegall, you didn't come to church. You didn't partake of the Lord's Supper. You didn't give your money. You didn't and list all these things to do with church. You weren't baptized. Is that why I'm lost? We go back, and I keep drawing you back to this question that you have to answer. If Jesus Christ had never come to this earth, would man be lost or would he be saved? Now, you have to answer that question if you want to progress any further in this study. Because that's what's being answered in this section right here. And as long as you hold out some hope for you or somebody else being saved apart from Jesus Christ, you'll never understand the gospel. The ground at the foot of the cross is level. Nobody stands any nearer than anybody else. We're all sinners, separated from God. Every single one of us. And our self-righteousness only gets in our way, just like that older brother in the parable. He was in worse shape than his younger brother because at least his younger brother knew he was lost, and the older brother didn't know he was lost. And if you don't know you're lost, you're not going to do anything to get saved. And so sometimes our goodness and our, quote, righteousness gets in the way of our being saved. Now, ain't that a kick in the teeth? Man. How do you deal with that? That kind of goes against everything I ever thought my whole life. So our first principle, here's our guy standing before God to be judged. And the first principle that God uses in chapter 2, verse 1, and I call it self-judgments. Have you ever, if God asked him the question, have you ever told somebody it's wrong to do something and then turn around and do that very same thing yourself? What's the answer? Yes. Everybody that's done that in here, raise your hand. Everybody that has not done that, raise your hand. Hey, your wife will straighten you out if you raise your hand, buddy. So, if that were the only principle that God used, what has been established here? When you ask and answer that question, what has been established? Pardon? You're a sinner, and you know it. God, that means that you have a standard of right and wrong. When you told somebody that it was wrong for you to do that, that says you have a standard of right and wrong. Doesn't say how high or how low that standard is, but it says you have a standard of right and wrong. And what I'm going to suggest to you in this section right here is that the way that God's going to judge that man, he's going to take the standard that that man lives by. You can call your own, I want to say you call your own poison, but you can call your own standard. And God will judge you by it. Name your own law. God will judge you by it. What's going to be the result? Now remember, when he came to the Sermon on the Mount, he said, you've heard it said by them of old times, thou shalt not commit adultery, but I say if you look upon a woman to lust after, you've committed adultery. You've heard it said by them of old times, thou shalt not kill, but I tell you, if you hate your brother, you've killed him. Man, that bar just got jerked up really high, didn't it? Because I can say I haven't committed adultery, and I can say that I haven't murdered anybody. But I can't say that that I've never looked lustfully upon a woman. I wish I could say that. I can't say that I have never had any hatred in my heart for somebody. I wish I could, but I can't say that. And so that's the first principle of judgment on the lawkeeper. Self-judgments. Whenever you say, whenever you admit, and you can't lie to God, whenever you say, yes, I have told someone that it's wrong to do something and done that very same thing myself, you just condemned yourself with your own mouth. You just said, I did what I knew was wrong. I knew there was a good and a bad, and I chose the bad. I knew there was a right and a wrong, and I chose the wrong. And what is sin? What is sin? Breaking God's law, right? The result is that we're separated, but sin is breaking God's law. And somebody says, well, I don't know if that's God's law or not. Okay, well, that's going to be our second point. I'm glad you said that, okay? Whether you said it or not, I set you up to say it anyway. Skip over to verse 12. We're pulling the principles out here. All who sin apart from the law will also perish apart from the law. And all who sin under the law will be judged by the law. Now, that one statement, where does that leave me and you? We're on the outside, aren't we? We're in the perishing group there, right? Whether you're under the law or you're not under the law, then you'll be judged by it, you'll perish, either under it or apart from it. And now, from verse 12 through 16, is one long compound sentence. There is a parenthesis. There's a parenthetical expression right in the middle of it. Why do we put parenthesis in a sentence? What do parentheses do? They explain something that you just said. And so, your Bible probably, if you have an NIV, it probably has parentheses that start at verse 14 and end at verse 15. Is that right? Well, actually, it starts in verse 13, the parenthesis should. And watch it. Because when you pull out verse 13, 14, and 15, and you read verse 12 and verse 16, you get the sentence. Let's read it that way so you'll know. Let's read verse 12 and then skip down and just keep going with verse 16 and leave out 13, 14, 15. All who sin apart from the law will also perish apart from the law, and all who sin under the law will be judged by the law. This will take place, this what? This judgment will take place on the day when God will judge men's secrets through Jesus Christ, as my gospel declares. Now, in between 13 and 16 is a parenthesis. And that parenthesis is really important. And let's read it. For it is not those who hear the law. Now notice he said, verse 13, all who sin apart from the law will perish apart from the law. All who sin under the law will be judged by the law. For it is not those who hear the law who are righteous in God's sight, but those who what? Obey the law, do the law, who will be declared righteous. Now, again, I want you to remember something. He's not talking about how you get saved here. He's talking about your relationship to law. And in fact, he's talking about why you're lost. Because you try to keep this law, and you can't keep it. But he pictures this person here. Though it's not those who hear the law, here's the principle about law. It's not those who hear the law who are righteous in God's sight, but those who obey the law. Now, we don't yet know to what degree you have to obey the law. But that's just the principle. Not just hearers, but those who do the law. Right? And then he says, indeed, when Gentiles who do not have the law, what law are we talking about? Moses' law, right? Indeed, when Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature the things required by the law, These become a law unto themselves, even though they do not have the law, since they show the requirements of the law written on their hearts. Stop right there. Now there's, he layered this thing. You got to put your mind to this a little bit to understand this. It's not overly hard, but you have to follow his reasoning. He says it's not the hearers, but the doers who are declared righteous. And then he says the Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature the things required by the law. These Gentiles who don't have the law, having not the law, become a law unto themselves. And here's some further additional proof that they do have the law themselves. They show the requirements of the law written on their hearts. Now let's stop right there. My second principle that God will use to judge is not my principle. The second principle in this context that God will use to judge the man under law, apart from Christ, never heard the gospel, is this principle, this truth. All men have God-given law. That's your next one. You can write that down. First one was self-judgments, verse 1. This one is, all men have God-given law. I don't care where they live, when they live, what society they lived in. Whether or not they ever saw a Bible, heard the gospel, or heard of Jesus Christ, had nothing to do with that. All men have God-given law. The Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively, some versions say, are naturally, are by nature, the things contained in the law. Where did they get that? Then he says they show the requirements of the law written where? On their hearts. Who's the heart writer? That would be God. God writes on the heart. Now, we're going to take some time, probably the rest of the class. I don't know if it'll take that long or not. We're going to take some time to talk about this law, this God-given law, and what some things about it. When did it become wrong to murder? In the history of the world, when did it become wrong? Was it Exodus chapter 20 when God gave the Ten Commandments? Or was it wrong before then? It was wrong before then. How do you know? Cain killed Abel. Good answer. Good answer. Cain killed Abel. And whenever God came to him and God said, Cain, where's your brother? He said, I killed him and he's laying right there. Look at him. See him? No, that's not what he said. Why did he not say that? Because he knew what he had done was wrong. Now, how did he know that? Because, that's exactly right, Randy said, there had been an incident that had happened prior to this that really messed things up. And that was what? Adam and Eve ate of the fruit of a tree. It wasn't just any tree. The tree had a name, and it was not an arbitrary name. What was the name of that tree that they ate the fruit of? The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And when they ate of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, what happened to them? They had the knowledge of good and evil. Right? And so it wasn't an arbitrary name he gave that tree. And from that time on, man is going to have an innate awareness of right and wrong. Now, we need to talk about that some, don't we? We really do need to understand we're talking about law right now. We're talking about here, in this case, an unwritten law. By the way, before I leave it, if you were to go to the law of Moses and you saw those Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, so forth, thou shalt not bear false witness, etc., you can go in the text before, and that happened in Exodus chapter 20 when the law of Moses was given. You can go prior to that time, and you can see that man, that these truths were not new truths that were revealed at Sinai. It did not become wrong to kill, steal, commit adultery on Mount Sinai. It was wrong before that. And by the way, and listen to this really carefully, it's still wrong today. Not because the Ten Commandments and the law of Moses said it was wrong. It's wrong because it's always been wrong. It was wrong before Mount Sinai. It was wrong for the Jews under the law of Moses. It was wrong for the Gentiles who lived contemporary with the Israelites while they were under the law of Moses. And it's still wrong today. These are eternal truth principles. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. And you know where they came from? One day, God in heaven, before he created man, he said, I'm going to create man, I'm going to make a club, and I'm going to try to think of 10 good rules that I think they ought to live by in order to be in my club. No, that's not what he did. You know where those 10 commandments came from? They came from God's very own nature. The Bible says, in the New Testament, at least twice, God cannot lie. But there's some other things God can't do. You know, I usually would set you up and say, what's the definition of God? And somebody will come up with a definition. One who is unlimited in all of his attributes. And that's not a bad definition. Not a bad definition. Are there some things God cannot do? Yes. There are some things God cannot do. What can God not do? He can't lie. He can't cheat. He can't steal. He can't commit adultery. Why? Because I said he couldn't. Let's get that real straight, okay? Not because I said he couldn't, but because that is God's nature. And so when God is thinking about his family and who's going to be in his family, then he chooses his very own characteristics. And he writes those on man's heart. And then in due time, after he's chosen Abraham and his descendants, to put up here for the whole world to see and learn about him from how he deals with this nation, then a day will come when he'll write these, have these written, or he will write these on a tablet of stone, and he will put punishments with them. Now, what does that accomplish? It's not that those are new truths. It is that if left to ourselves, we're going to say adultery is not that big a deal. And we'll give it a nice name. Or we'll say, lying is not really that big a deal. And we'll give it a nice name. And so it goes. I'm okay, you're okay. But God said, you're not okay. And he put those eternal truth principles down on a tablet of stone. And he gave punishments with them. And those punishments said, if a man's caught in the act of adultery, what's to happen to him? Kill him. Kill him. What does that do? It reminds us that sin is a terrible thing. That's what it does. It tells us how God feels about sin, because if he leaves us to ourselves, we're going to talk sin out of existence. And we'll talk God out of existence. But he put those Ten Commandments there with the punishments so that man would know, so that, as he will say later, so that sin would become exceedingly sinful. It's really a big deal. It's kind of like that guy picking up the sticks on the Sabbath. Would you have said that was a real big deal? Was that a big enough deal to get killed over? Everybody ought to have to stone him? I wouldn't have thought so. Would you? I would have thought he needs some chastisement. You know, he needs a warning or something, but kill him? God said, kill him. And so, as we look at these 10 principles, let's think about this a minute. Is it possible for one person to do something and it not bother their conscience and somebody else not do that thing, or if they did it, it would bother their conscience? So how do we get this? How do we get this knowledge? The Gentile who does not have the law does by nature the things contained in the law. These having not a law become a law unto themselves. How do we get this? What do we do with this knowledge of right and wrong? Well, let me illustrate. One of these days I'm going to go through with what I say every time I teach this class. I'm going to do them. Come up with a bar graph. Everybody knows what a bar graph is, right? And it's coming up this way. Well, just pretend that I've got a bar graph up here, and you can all see it, and it's got 10 bars on it. And over one of them, it says, thou shalt not kill. Over the next one, it says, thou shalt not steal. Over the next one, it says, thou shalt not commit adultery. All the way, 10 commandments. Now, just for the sake of accuracy, since we happen to be our lesson this morning anyway, I'm going to say that the Sabbath law is an exception. Jesus himself will say, man was not made for the Sabbath, but Sabbath was made for man, and he quote, violated that and so forth. It was given for a particular reason. But for our sake, if you'll allow me, I will just say that you got 10 bars up here. Each one of these represents an eternal truth. Now, let's take adultery. Let's just pull that bar graph out here. We got it right here standing beside me. God says the level of right and wrong on adultery is right here, just right at the top of my head right here. But I live in a society that over generations has lowered that standard. And they will say, well, it's not that big a deal. It's not that you can never, ever do that. If your husband beats you and you do this and you do this and this happens, or your wife does this or doesn't do this or whatever, then, you know, it's permissible for you to commit adultery. And so instead of being right here, I put it down here. And there may be a society somewhere that says, hey, let's just all live all together and share one another, and, you know, women and men all live together, and whoever wants to have sex with one another can have it. And you know, you teach your kids that, and you know, a few generations, then that bar is down here. Or, you know, you could say down here, wherever you want to say. But here's the point I want to make. In every society and in every person's heart, there is an awareness of right and wrong about adultery. It may be down here, it may be here, it may be here, it may be here. There is some, at some place on this bar graph, you draw a line. And you say, as long as you stay above this line, then everything is fine. But if you drop below this line, it's wrong. And this is the dividing line. And we move over here and we take the bar graph on lying. And the same thing is true. You may draw yours up here. I may draw mine right here. In fact, those of us that grew up in, if I can say, middle class America, you know, basically went to the same type of school, so forth, were taught essentially the same thing. We're somewhat homogeneous on this, okay? Our variation of right and wrong, and those of us that grew up in a, quote, Christian environment, our variations on what's right and what's wrong are relatively short. I mean, you may draw yours here and I draw mine here, and somebody else may draw it right here. But among us, there's usually not somebody that draws it way, way, way down here. Okay? So our variation is relatively short. But there are no two of us that draw our line on right and wrong in exactly the same place on all 10. No two of us. If you don't believe that, even when you get married and you think that you're compatible with your husband or wife, you'll find out before very long that you think differently about some things, don't you? I mean, it's inevitable. It happens, right? And you have to sit down and discuss that. And one of you may persuade the other one, and particularly if one of you is really, really overbearing, you know, the other one might say, okay, what do you say, you know. But not necessarily really persuaded, just, you know, agree to go along, to get along. But we have variations. And it's kind of like our thumbprints. They're all a little bit different. Now, where did we get that awareness? Why do we draw our line where we draw our line on each one of these 10 bar graphs? What are some things that affect where we draw our line? You tell me. The what? Environment. And specifically what? Okay, mama. And Eric's pointing to his mama sitting beside him here. what your mother taught you, what your daddy taught you, what your teachers taught you, what your peers teach you, what society teaches you, what you observe for yourself. These are things that all affect where you draw your line. And if you grew up in Zambia, Africa, as opposed to the woodlands, then you're probably going to draw your line fairly significantly differently than somebody, than the other person, right? And so if your background was really different, then you're going to draw your line substantially different than somebody else. I understand that there are tribes in Papua New Guinea and a few other places in the world that believe that if they kill their enemies and eat their heart, then they gained all their power. Now, you believe that? Neither do I. I don't want to eat anybody's heart. I don't want to kill anybody. And if I did somehow do that, I don't believe that I would believe that I gained their strength by doing that. But I understand that they believe that. And so they can kill somebody and even mutilate them and it not bother them at all. And they don't think that's wrong. You think that's true? You think it's possible to be taught something like that and you think that that's okay? Oh, yeah, it is. And society can depart so far from God and become so depraved that it will get to a point that there's nothing within that society that would cause anybody to turn to God. And evidently, at that point, God's going to cause something to happen to that nation. History has borne that out. That He would tell Abraham when he came through Canaan the first time, he said, I'm going to give your descendants this land, but I'm not going to give it to you. I'm going to give it to them in about 400 years because I'm not going to give it to you now because their cup of iniquity is not yet full. What does that mean? It means that that society had not digressed to the point of total depravity at that point. Maybe there was still something within that society that would cause a person to look to God and maybe turn to God. But there can reach a point where there's nothing in a society that causes someone to turn to God. And boy, it would be a really sad thing to be born into that country at that time, wouldn't it? And so even in a way, there was mercy in God bringing a flood on the earth because the children, right? They were in a relationship with God. And so there was some mercy there. Those children growing up through the process they would have gone through would have not had any thought about turning to God, wouldn't have any way to know about God in that society. And so the second point is, all men have God-given law. You may be different than mine. You are different than mine. You draw your line here or here or here, and I draw mine here on each one of these. And my point is this. God, I believe, will take your fingerprint, your bar graph, and he'll judge you by it. And what's going to be the outcome? All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Have you ever told somebody it's wrong to do something and then turn around and done that very same thing yourself? Yes, you have. What does that mean? That means that you drop below your line that you drew on this. And so is God going to open the Bible and judge you by something you never saw before? No. He's going to take the law that you live by and judge you by it. This is going to happen, he says, on the day that God will judge men's secrets through Jesus Christ, as my gospel declares. Verse 16. What's going to take place? God will take the law that you live by. He said, you name your own. I'll take the one that you accepted as right and wrong, and I'll judge you by it. And what's going to be the result? If you have one single sin, you can't come into heaven. What's going to be the result? You ain't going to make it. Now, we've come to my time's run out, and I always hate it when my time runs out because it just gets people's minds going with me, but here's where we're going with this. Whatever hope that you have held out, I'll give you an illustration. My brother-in-law, really good guy, good friend, love him, love to be around him. He came to one of my classes one time, and I was in El Dorado, Arkansas, and he lived in Monroe, Louisiana, and he worked in Little Rock, and he had to drive through, and so he made sure that he drove through on Monday nights when I had my class at my home. And after about 4 weeks, he stayed after class, and he'd leave. My class was over about 9 o'clock, and he'd leave and drive another 2 hours to Little Rock. But he stayed one night, and he said, "I need to talk to you." I said, "Okay, what?" He said, "When I started this class, I had a little bit of hope. But I don't have any hope anymore." I said, "Good. Do you understand? That's exactly what I'm trying to do to every one of us. I've got to get all of your hope of you being righteous and being good enough to go to heaven. I've got to get it all. Every little piece of it." And if you think, you know, you start out a class like this and you say, you know, I can only be 80% righteous. God's going to have to take care of this 20%. And as you study, you realize, boy, I can't be 80% righteous. I can only be, when you really get good, you say, I can only be 20% righteous, and God's going to have to take care of 80%. You know what? You can't be 20% righteous. You can't be 10% righteous. You can't be 1% righteous. And when you stand before God, you don't want any of your righteousness. Because if your righteousness has one sin in it, you're a dead man. There is another way that God makes us righteous that is apart from law. But until we work this thing over about trying to be righteous under law, we're not going to be ready for being apart from law. If you don't know you're lost, you won't take the medicine to get saved. Comment? Question? Criticism? Pardon? Okay. Tyrone said, in Noah's time, the Bible said that God found one righteous man in the world. And by the way, we're going to find out that that righteousness wasn't because he was better than everybody else. We'll see. Thank you.